Hello to all you boys next door, mums and dads, new weds and nearly deads, and welcome to Dangerous Amusements, a podcast where we talk about the music of Elvis Costello. I'm Stu Arrowsmith, and in each episode I'll be joined by a special guest to chat all things Elvis, and I'll be asking them to help me compile the ultimate Elvis Costello playlist. Now remember, don't make any sudden movements, because these are Dangerous Amusements. My guest for this episode is a writer and editor, and one of the authors of the popular Elvis Costello Song of the Week feature. Welcome to Dangerous Amusements, Jorge Farah.
Hey, hi Stu. So nice to be here. I'm a huge fan of your show, and it's surreal to be actually talking to you this time.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you for coming on, because you're early morning where you are, I think.
Well, early is relative. It's 10 a.m., but it's Argentina, so that's basically 6 a.m. everywhere else in the world. It's a country that runs a little late.
good stuff. And of course, your role over there, you're writer and editor of a music and culture publication over there. You're based in Buenos Aires?
Yeah, so I am actually from Colombia, Barranquilla, Colombia, the coastal city of Barranquilla. And I've been living in Buenos Aires, Argentina, which is still South America, but way further down south, for the last 18 years. It's going to be 18 years this month. And I am a content producer. I work with all kinds of projects. I run Lalalista, which is the website that you just mentioned, the arts and culture website. We cover Argentine music, films, art, comics, anything that's culture and independent and interesting to us. We are a group of writers from all corners of the globe who happen to meet here in Argentina and become good friends with each other and decide that, hey, we want to show the world the great things that are happening in this country and the great musicians that exist here and that people may not have heard about because they maybe don't have backing of major labels and such. So we've been doing that for the last few years, and it's been fantastic. I'm a big fan of documenting what's happening here.
Great. We will come back to the wider picture of Argentine music a little bit later in our conversation. But of course, a lot of people listening in will know you through that brilliant feature that you were involved in, Trunkworthy, the Elvis Costello Song of the Week feature, which I used to read all the time. And I used to look forward to seeing which songs you were going to tackle and the different perspectives that you and your colleagues had. How did your involvement in that come about?
So, yeah, Trunkworthy was this wonderful website that was run by David Gorman and Gary Stewart, the dearly departed Gary Stewart. And so these are two people who are American music business executives, I believe. I hope if David listens to this, he won't be mad if I get some facts wrong. I never met Gary, unfortunately. My understanding is that they were two close friends. Gary was such a huge music enthusiast and such a fan of culture that he actually, and such a fan of sharing culture that he actually carried around a bunch of different films and albums in the trunk of his car so that if he was ever in a situation where he wanted, something came up and he just was like, oh my God, I think you love this album. He would just go into his trunk and carry it and bring it out. So something is deemed trunk-worthy if it's deemed worthy of celebrating and keeping and sharing. So they started this website together. The original Elvis Costello Song of the Week column was the two of them, Gary and David, going back and forth talking about a different Elvis Costello song that they loved. We read that feature. It went on for a while. And then after they ended it, my friend Kevin Davis is a fantastic author, also American, and a good friend of mine that I met online on the message board of a band that will remain nameless. And we developed a shared fondness or a shared appreciation for Elvis Costello. And we talking over, I think it was Facebook Messenger one day, we were like, what if we tried our hand at writing this column that these guys kept going for so long that we think should continue? And so we did. And we started it up on Tumblr for a while. We started doing a song a week on Tumblr. And then after we did that for about 6 months or so, we sent an email to David Gorman, who was still running Trunkworthy. And we said, can you let us do this for you? Can we bring our blog to you and sort of become the rebooted version of the Elvis Costello Song of the Week? David was very gracious and he was absolutely excited about the idea. And we did that for a while. We wrote it for a couple years, I believe. I can't quite remember. The timeline gets a little blurry for me. We wrote about several songs that we love, and it was an honor to talk about this great musician that we both love so much and whose work means so much to us that, for whatever reason, both Kevin and I are sort of isolated from the rest of the world. We don't have anybody in our lives that we can talk to about Elvis Costello. We just happened to start doing it with each other on an online publication. So that was very fun to do.
Yeah. Oh, it was fun to read as well. And what was your process for deciding the songs that you'd tackle in that feature?
Kevin and I had a list. We both had a list of songs that meant something to us, that were significant to us in some way. And for Trunkworthy, the rule was that we both had to love the song. Now, both Kevin and I were huge Elvis Costello fans, so there weren't a lot of songs that we didn't love. But there were a couple occasions in the previous iteration of our attempt at the Song of the Week that one of us felt a little more strongly about a song than the other. There were a couple of occasions where one of us maybe wasn't a big fan. So that would result in a post that was, you know, one of them ardently defending the song and the other one being like, oh, I don't know, it's not, I prefer this other one that sounds similar, but it's from a different album. So when we moved over to Trunkworthy, that's one of the things that David told us. He was like, okay, so our website is all about celebrating what we love. So we can't have a column that's, you know, meh on a song, right? You gotta only do songs you both love. And so we did that and it wasn't hard. We both are passionate about every little obscure little corner of Elvis Costello's discography. So it was easy for us to be able to find something to talk about in basically every little corner of his body of work. And it was great. We did that for a while. Eventually, we found that we were sort of repeating ourselves. We found that we were treading the same ground. We found that we were running out of adjectives to describe how much we love a certain song or how much we love a certain arrangement or a certain lyric. And we decided to put it to rest after a while. And we ended, I think the last one we did was Suspect My Tears from Look Now. And I think that's a great song to end on. I think that's a high point. You know, we ended on a song that we felt was like, okay, this guy's still doing his best work. It's incredible that this many years into his career, he's still putting out this level of song. I think we can put this to rest and end on a good note here.
Yeah, I love that song, actually. So when did you first discover Elvis's music?
Well, I very clearly remember my first exposure to Elvis Costello as a photograph, as an image. It was a write-up that was included in an old copy of a Rolling Stone book, some sort of 500 greatest rock musicians of all time book that I found in my dad's office. And I remember seeing him. That was my first exposure without ever having heard a note of his music. And I remember thinking, well, that guy looks cool. And the write-up made him sound cool. It was written, I think, around the time of Armed Forces was about to come out. So it's incredible that he was already being considered one of the greatest musicians of all time at that time. But the first time I actually heard his music, I remember this very clearly, it was on TV. There was a show that used to play on the channel A&E called Live by Request, where musicians, the concept was the musicians would go on stage and start playing live and people would call in with the request. And it would, you know, fun live music show. Now, it didn't play live in Colombia, where I'm from, because they needed time to subtitle it. But I did catch the rerun of the broadcast. Elvis played that with the Imposters in 2003. And I remember it very clearly because the first thing that struck me was, oh, that's the guy from the Rolling Stone book. And oh, he is cool. He's funny and he's eloquent and he's like so distinguished and all that. And I remember thinking, man, I like this guy already. And then the performances. It was a great show. He played I Hope You're Happy Now. He played Radio Radio. He played Beyond Belief. Many songs that would appeal to a teenager who was at the time still in the midst of his 70s punk phase, which, not to say that I'm no longer that guy, I'm going to see Marky Ramone tonight. But it's still, those songs were like very much up my alley. But the moment that really caught my attention, that made me get up from my seat and stand real close to the TV set, was with Elvis and Steve started to perform a selection of songs from North. They played Fallen and they played Still. And I remember being like, oh my God, these are some of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard. Like, this guy's the real deal. And that started my fandom. I started collecting CDs after that. You know, I started with the Greatest Hits album. And then just because I'm, you know, shortly after that, I moved to Argentina. There's not a whole lot that was available to me. So I would just, every little morsel that I could find, I would devour. So I absorbed his discography in a sort of haphazard way. I remember one of my first albums was when I was Cruel, which I don't think is the case for many Elvis Costello fans, that that's one of their first albums that they listened to. Then after that one, I think Brutal Youth. And then after that one, I skipped back to the 80s and started Imperial Bedroom. And it's like a puzzle that I started building piece by piece, but completely out of any sort of sequential order, which I count as a blessing. I really like that I was able to do that. I really like that I didn't absorb his music in real time. I mean, I couldn't have. He started making music long before I was born. But I'm glad that I got to experience his later stuff first, because I found that I found that a lot of Elvis Costello fans who are mostly into the 70s and 80s stuff are very dismissive of his later period. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to say that they're wrong. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion. But I'm so glad that I have that wealth of material from the 90s and 2000s that I think is incredible and I think is every bit as worth celebrating as his earlier stuff. So, yeah, it was like a puzzle I put together over the course of many years. And the first Elvis Costello album that I experienced as a fan, like this is a new Elvis Costello album that came out and I'm already a fan, was The River in Reverse. That one I remember was a big one for me, and it opened my eyes. I was never a big fan of New Orleans soul music or brass music of any kind. I didn't know who Alan Toussaint was, but as with many occasions in my life, Elvis served as the lens through which I absorbed music that now ranks as some of my favorite of all time.
I suppose that's a similar experience for me, being a younger fan as well, starting to listen to him in the 90s. Mm. You just kind of take everything as it comes. You don't have any preconceived ideas about what sort of artist you thought he was, or therefore what kind of records he should make. You take them as you come. And for me, Mighty Like a Rose was the first one. And that was almost the template of what I thought an Elvis Costello record would be after that. And of course, one of the songs from there is one of the highlights of that By Request show that you mentioned as well, when he performs Couldn't Call It Unexpected, number 4.
Oh my God, that's such a great performance. He sings off mic and his voice just fills up the entire hall. And that is such a gorgeous song. And that's so interesting that Mighty Like a Rose was your starting point, because to a lot of fans that, I mean, I've heard it being called, some people have called it like a low point, and I just totally disagree with that. I don't understand how anybody could take that album and consider it a low point. It's filled with such gorgeous songs, such intricate like arrangements, lush production, great singing. Elvis was doing something very different with his voice at that point. Acerbic, kind of bitter sounding songs, but really great. Mighty Like a Rose is an album that I have a lot of affection for. I'm glad that that was your first one, and I'm glad that it gets some love every once in a while when it gets mentioned on this podcast.
Yeah, we love Mighty Like a Rose here, so always happy to bring the conversation back to that. Okay, let's start having a look at some of the songs that you've picked for us to talk about. We're going to have a new playlist for this season of the podcast. We'll call it Powder and Perfume, and we'll put it on my website at the end of the series. The rules are the same as always, though. You're going to pick 6 songs for it. Each one must be a Costello track from a different decade, from the 1970s up to the 2020s.
We'll be right back.
So your first choice comes from the 1970s, and this was eventually released as the B-side of Clubland in 1980, but could have been the opening track on Armed Forces. It's Clean Money.
That's right. Such a great song, such like a driving rock and roll rhythm. One of the great things about absorbing Elvis's music later than, you know, rather than when it came out, is that you have access to all these great bonus discs that came out when the albums were reissued, right? And so a song that I wouldn't have normally found if I was just traversing his discography sort of sequentially is now one of my favorites, which is Clean Money. Now, it's insane to me that this song was recorded for Armed Forces. It sounds to me nothing like Armed Forces, not just because of the actual songwriting, but the sonics of the song. It sounds much more like something that would have been in this year's Model. It has that sort of manic energy. And it also serves as a preview of the kind of frantic, frenetic playing that we would get on Get Happy. It sort of, it lives in both worlds. I think it's a great song. I love the chunkiness of the guitars. I love the descending chords right before it transitions back into the refrain. I love the voice. I think Dave Edmunds is doing backup vocals in this song.
He is, yeah.
And so it's mad to me. Like, I don't know anybody else who's ever mentioned this song. Like, I literally, it's one of the most obscure songs, and I don't pick it to be an Elvis Costello hipster. I just think it's legitimately a fantastic song. Right up there with, I think when you had Connor Ratliff, he picked Wednesday Week from this, I think also a Armed Forces outtake. I think those two songs go together very well. They also make, you could put them together as a nice little single. And it would be fantastic. Clean Money is great. I love the playing of the Attractions. It's a great showcase for the Attractions and the kind of I hesitate to call it punk because it's not really. It's a little smarter than a lot of the punk that was happening at the time, but that really frantic and aggressive energy of the late 70s new wave explosion is in good display here. So Clean Money's fantastic.
Elvis described it as an arrangement that owes quite a bit to the Beatles' White Album rockers, or more likely to the Beatles' influenced sound of Cheap Trick. And it's interesting to think it could have opened Armed Forces, because that, of course, means we wouldn't have had Accidents Will Happen opening that record. It also means we wouldn't have ultimately got Love for Tender opening Get Happy, because obviously he reuses a lot of the lyrics for it. So, you know, that thing about the butterfly flapping its wings and, you know, all these other changes would come about, that it's difficult to imagine those two records opening in any different way.
If Clean Money opens Armed Forces, it's a completely different record. Like, you change one piece of the puzzle and the whole thing just looks completely different. I'm happy that they didn't, because Accidents Will Happen is a perfect opener for Armed Forces. But it's fun to think about. It's fun to consider those sort of alternate universe where this is a totally different album.
But he's certainly from that era of musicians and artists who give you great B-sides as well. Back in the days when singles were a thing, his B-sides were, in many cases, as good as what was on the flip side as well. And of course, as you said before, for those of us a bit later, you get them all on the reissues of the albums as well. And there's so much great material.
There's a lot to love about the streaming era. There's a lot to love about the way that music is released now. As a fan, speaking as a fan, not as a musician, because there's a lot to dislike about that from that point of view. But I still sort of mourn the loss of the bonus tracks, of the bonus reissues. You know, that they were the great Rhino reissues of the 90s and 2000s that have this wealth of material. So much of my Elvis Costello discovery was aided by those bonus tracks and those bonus discs. I wonder what will replace them, because I know that Elvis is still making great B-sides. I guess maybe he just saves them up for a future compilation now. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's move straight into the next song choice, because that falls into a similar category as well of being a wonderful song that wasn't released on one of the main albums at the time, but we subsequently get it on a reissue. So let's take your next choice, which comes from the 1980s.
There's an old man's fantasy food in a young girl's mouth. Like cheap pink lipstick smeared on a wedding dress. Will you look what you've done to her? Will you look at this disgrace? Oh, it's all over your suffering face.
Okay, so this is your 1980s song choice. Could have been considered for King of America, but ultimately it comes out on a reissue many years later. What a wonderful song, Suffering Face.
Absolutely. King of America is an interesting album. It's a great album. I love it very much, and I don't want to be misconstrued as saying that it's lesser in any way. It's an album that is sharply divided between these gorgeous acoustic ballads like Sleep of the Just and I'll Wear It Proudly and Indoor Fireworks. But then also it has a lot of more upbeat stuff, The Big Light. So I happen to fall into the side of I prefer maybe the more melodic side of Elvis Costello's songwriting. So I personally would have liked King of America to be more of a ballads album, just ballads. I think it would have been like the guitar version of North, I guess. And maybe that's something that only I would like. But you kind of get a glimpse of the album that it could have been with the bonus tracks, with a bonus disc from the reissue, because it includes what amounts to an EP's worth of home demos. And these demos are, you know, they include songs that would eventually make it to the albums in many cases, but then in other cases, songs that would eventually be kind of stripped apart and used for different songs. But I love these demos because they're simple, they're unadorned, they're just guitar and vocals, and there's something very interesting about how they're performed. If you listen to these demos and like the song Deporte, and there's a version of I Hope You're Happy Now in there, there's an almost slurred delivery in Elvis' voice. It sounds like he's recording after a night of drinking. And when I looked into the liner notes for the reissue, Elvis describes the tape that he used to record these songs as being labeled EC as JR. And that's a reference to Jimmy Reed, who apparently used to drink until he fell off his chair. So they're clearly songs of somebody who's been out drinking or who's been in drinking for a while. But it fits the songs really well because the tracks, and especially Suffering Face, they're marked with that raw emotional honesty that seems to only come out in a state of at least partial inebriation. Those like sudden bursts of sincerity that maybe surprise even you and that you would dismiss or even apologize for the next morning because of maybe you said some harsh truths. Suffering Face is a beautiful song. It's to me like a slurred confession on a telephone line at 3 a.m. And it's expressed with such vulnerability and tenderness. It's a gorgeous melody. I don't know why he didn't choose to make it into a fully fledged song for the album. I know parts of the song would turn into Crimes of Paris for Blood and Chocolate. And I may be wrong, but I think the main melody would eventually be reused in When I Was Cruel, the first When I Was Cruel, not When I Was Cruel number two. It's at least very similar, if not the same exact melody. But this is a song that I've loved for a long time. I wish more people talked about it. I love that the lyrics are sort of about this tale of mutual disappointment, of a couple fighting hard to stay in love with each other and just finding that they can't communicate. It's lovely. It's sad, but it's just lovely. I love this song so much.
It's just Elvis and his acoustic guitar recorded Sunset Sound in LA in February 1985. And lyrically, it kind of foreshadows So Like Candy a bit, doesn't it? You know, the references to the perfume scattering things around the room. And then you have the, you know, the nice payoff at the end, whereas in that song, you get the note on the scratched records, and on this one, it's the steam on the mirror, which I love that line, the "you left your love and other threats in the steam faded on my bathroom mirror," I think is up there with anything he said on Couldn't Call It Unexpected as being one of the just the most memorable images in his entire catalogue for me.
Absolutely. And the way the melody sort of lifts with that line in particular, it's just such a great construction of songwriting. He's really great at finding the way to amplify the emotional truth of his words with the music, or maybe to find the music, to find the words for the music that he already came up with. I don't know his process, but it's such a beautifully written song. I know some folks have issue with the... There's a line where he goes, "You don't need that same old rivet gun. You need a brand new wrench." For some reason, I don't know, some people don't like that line. I love it. I think it's weird, but in a really good way. Just kind of a strange comparison. It's like you don't need me. I'm an old tool for you. You need to move on to something else, a tool that does something completely different. I like that. It's a good way to illustrate how useless one feels when a relationship is crumbling around you and you can't do anything about it.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think it's a great line. And as you mentioned, he uses some of the lines to go on to do Crimes of Paris. I'm a bit surprised that he doesn't kind of go back in and take more of the lines out for future songs as well. But I guess he's just got so many good lyrics lying around that he hasn't got room to squeeze everything in, because some of these lines would be someone else's best ever lyric, I think.
Yeah, I think he also, even though he does sort of cannibalize his repertoire every once in a while, I do think that he enjoys having this super deep songbook, to the point where he will, every once in a while, he'll perform this extremely obscure demo outtake that only 12 people in the audience probably know, and he'll play it in a show. It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, we are finding room for this on the album, aren't we? If we're going to go back in time and we were allowed to assemble our own King of America, surely you're joining me in saying we're dropping Eisenhower Blues and we're putting this on instead.
Yeah. And I actually have done that. I have a playlist that's sort of my version of, and people, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's sacrilege. I'm positioning myself like I know more than the artist, but I have my own sort of retracked version of King of America. That's the dream album that I hope that, or that I prefer. But hey, look, it's not going to replace anybody else's copy. I'm not campaigning for it. It's just my own little thing.
This is Dangerous Amusements, the podcast that seemed like a fine idea at the time.
When you were sort of getting into his music in Colombia, and you mentioned you watched the TV show and things like that, how present was Elvis and his music in the sort of the cultural landscape back then?
I think, less than zero is a good way to put it. Elvis Costello was not a figure of any kind of influence where I grew up in Colombia. I think potentially we may have played She on the radio every once in a while when Notting Hill was a big thing. Because She, as you may know, is a single that was actually successful down in South America. But it completely evaded me. I did not know anything about Elvis Costello until I picked up the big book at my dad's office. I don't think he had any cultural presence. And in fact, I don't know how popular he is in South America. I know that he had a planned tour in maybe like 2010 or something that eventually fell apart because of, I believe, lack of ticket sales. So he doesn't have a huge fan base here. Maybe it's grown in recent years, but it very much feels like an island of Costello fans. And it's me and 20 other dudes. It makes it sound so sad. But no, it's, I wish there were more. I definitely would love to see him live again. The one time I saw him in Buenos Aires, the only time he's played in Buenos Aires, was in 2005. I had just moved here. And it was such a great show. I had a fantastic time. It was an Imposters show. It was at a festival, but to me, it didn't make a difference. I was seeing Elvis Costello. And it was, I don't know, epiphanic is the best way I could describe it. he played Shipbuilding, and I remember very clearly that there was this one guy singing very loudly along with it, which to me was surprising. Like, why is this a sing-along for you? It's not what I would call a sing-along song. And then later found out that guy was Fito Páez, who later participated with Elvis in the Spanish Model album. Later, I saw some folks refer to it as a sort of a standard imposters set. But to me, it was amazing. I was still not deep into his discography at the time, so basically every song he played was new to me. I didn't know many of them, and I just remember feeling like, oh my god, this guy is everything. Like, he's everything that I'm into. I was into The Clash, and he played songs that to me sounded like Joe Strummer. I was into jazz, and he played Shipbuilding, which is a beautiful, basically like a jazz ballad. I was a big Tom Waits fan at the time, and he played Episode of Blonde, which has sort of Tom Waits energy. Every facet of my music listening that I was into at the time sort of coalesced on stage with this one guy. And that's when I knew there was no going back.
She was a smitten on her first by a curious fella. She said, I love the way you talk. So she liked to sing along to her favorite song from the year that she was born. See how mischievous is her face. You're gonna woke up in the 80s. So speak to me.
So this is your next song. We're going into the 1990s for this one, and this was released on the soundtrack to the Coen Brothers movie The Big Lebowski. This is My Mood Swings.
A song that fits the movie perfectly. I wish it was more prominently featured in the film. It's only on in the background, I think, during a very quiet doctor scene. And it's a great song. This is such a fun song. I love how rocking it is. I love that it's somewhat bluesy. I love that it's very playful. It's delivered with a wink and a smile. And there's also something deeply satisfying just about the sonics of the sound, the way that it sounds, the way that guitars resonate. I think it's a great sounding song. Mark Rebo, I believe, is playing guitar on that one. And that's a great collaboration. I would love for Elvis to work more with Mark, because everything they've ever done together is great for me. But yeah, this is a fantastic song from a fantastic soundtrack. And it was hard to think to pick a song, because the 90s were such a great decade for Elvis Costello. Everything he did in the 90s was gold. And it was so eclectic too, right? Like, you had the Juliet Letters, you had Mighty Like a Rose, and then you had Painted from Memory, and then you have a song like this. It's one that I don't see many people talk about, but one that I love very deeply. It's a great, rollicking song.
Mark Rebo, the other musicians on there, Greg Cohen on bass, Jim Keltner on drums. It's co-written by Elvis and Cotto Reardon and produced by T-Bone Burnett. And Greg Cohen responsible for those really cool little bass runs on the track as well, which are really
nice. Oh yeah, and the drums sound great as well. It makes sense that that's him. Yeah, it's a sound that he doesn't explore very much, this kind of chunky bluesy guitar type sound, but it's one that every time he dips into that, I'm a big fan. I love the alliteration and the lyrics, and I love how funny it is. It's a funny song. The lyrics are strange, but really intriguing. And it fits the Big Lebowski perfectly. It fits the vibe of the movie, the strangeness of it, the sort of throwbackness sound of it. I think it's great.
And I have to add this to my list of films that I've watched purely because I know there was an Elvis song in there, which also tragically includes Spice World with the Spice Girls and the aforementioned Notting Hill as well. So I've wasted several hours of my life. And I think if you add certainly like this and E.T., the amount of time that the Elvis songs actually spend on screen, it was maybe not worth it.
Very little. But hey, Big Lebowski's a great movie. That's That's in the running for one of my favorite movies of all time. I love that movie.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah. Were you not a fan? You look like you're not impressed.
I watched it purely because I knew there was an Elvis song in it. And I'm not a great movie fan, to be honest.
I see.
You know, if I've got 2 hours and a chance to watch something, I will probably just watch Ghostbusters again for the millionth time in my life.
Got it.
Let's go into the new century. And I know this is an album that you feel really strongly about. You mentioned before that it was one that really caught your attention very early on when you were getting into Elvis's music. And this is from the album North, and you're going to choose the song Someone Took the Words Away.
Poor head can hardly move my lips for speaking. I said, so what is this thing I can't explain? I blame all the things I feel but can't quite place. Perhaps they're written on
growing up in a lot of ways means not getting mad at what strangers say on the internet. Like that's one of the things that marks, at least in our time, maturity. I feel very immature anytime I read a review of North, because North is an album that is not ranked highly at all. North is an album that I'm constantly defending, I think, even from the staunchest Elvis Costello fans. I think it's a gorgeous album. I think it's an album that came straight from the heart, an album that nobody else could have written. And I think it's an album that deserves its day in the sun, really, because when it came out, it seemed like it couldn't really find its audience. Elvis Costello fans didn't like it because it was seen as the syrupy ballads album, and jazz people didn't like it because it seemed like a dilettante rock star trying to write jazz ballads. I think it's every song in North is perfect. It's such a musically and melodically sophisticated album. The songs are not catchy in by, you know, sort of traditional definition, but there is a sense of harmony and fluidity in the songs, and Someone Took the Words Away is my favorite song on North. It's just this, at first, it might sound impenetrable because it's so dour. It's a sad song. It's a song about not having the words anymore. How horrible for somebody to have, like Elvis, to find himself so tongue-tied, right? Let's say I'm so despondent that I don't even have words to describe it. But in its despondency, there is this incredible beauty. The chords that open the song are just these gorgeous jazz chords, piano chords, this motif that reoccurs throughout, and the melody that Elvis sings on top of it. It's just every bit of it is probably the prettiest, saddest song you've ever heard. And I would also say that the closing solo by the alto sax legend Lee Konitz is probably one of my favorite recorded pieces of music ever. However long it is, I don't know, 40 seconds or something. It's just unbelievably beautiful. It's up there with Chet Baker on Shipbuilding. Even though Elvis Costello has integrated jazz influences to his music before, like, you know, the song Almost Blue, North is the first album where he's completely breaking away from pop conventions and from his traditional sound. It's one of the things that makes me a little apprehensive about saying that it's sometimes it's my favorite Elvis Costello album. Oh, it's weird to say that because it doesn't sound like anything else he's ever done. So how can it be my favorite? But it's to me, it's just gorgeous. I can listen to it over and over again. The ballads are beautiful. It ends in such an uplifting note. It has this gorgeous dramatic arc to it. It almost feels like a movie. I remember when Connor was on, he talked about the song Impatience, which he regards as not fitting in. He listened to the album and understood I'm in the Mood Again as the closer. Well, when I purchased this album, the closer was Impatience. And to me, it serves perfectly as a closer because it's such a like detour from the rest of the album. It sounds like the party at the end of this long tragedy. It sounds like it ends in a wedding rather than in a funeral. But yeah, it's a great album. I don't understand. I recently bought the uncut. There was an issue that they released, an Elvis Costello song guide. I don't know if you saw that. And it includes a retrospective on each of his albums. And as part of it, they talked about North. And when they talked about what critics said, oh my God, I felt it. I felt it, man. I felt it boiling inside of me again. I'm like, oh, these people don't get it. Come on. It's such a cinematic album. And the people who found it samey, I guess, were not listening close enough, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's one that Elvis is very proud of. I don't know if it was in that uncut edition that you mentioned or another recent magazine when he was talking about how proud he remains of it to this day. And it was the first album that he'd orchestrated all by himself. And he said, I know this one divided listeners who were led to believe that it was something to do with an empty martini glass or a dissolute man in an undone bow tie. While at the time, I believed that I'd written a cracking folio of Lieder, only not in German. And every single track is important to the story of the album, isn't it? It's a bit like Jenga. If you pulled one piece out, the whole thing would fall apart and wouldn't make sense. It is a journey from beginning to end.
For sure, for sure. And that's a great way to describe it, how Elvis, the quote that you just mentioned. People were hoping for it to be in the Wee Small Hours, maybe, or some sort of In the Wee Small Hours facsimile. It's not. It's something richer and more complex than that, more nuanced. I'm a staunch defender of this album, and I'm also grateful that it's the album that brought me my friendship with Kevin Davis, who I wrote the Elvis Costello Song of the Week with for a while, because he and I bonded over that album. That was the first conversation we ever had, was talking about how good it was. So it's an album that means a lot to me personally as well.
I'm glad you picked out the solo towards the end as well, because I love that. And it also, this album also has one of my other favorite solos on any Elvis record, which is that flugelhorn part on Let Me Tell You About Her as well. So I think instrumentally, this is a really beautifully made record.
Yeah, for sure. I'm on the hunt for a vinyl copy. I haven't been able to find it anywhere at a price that makes sense to me. So if anybody knows anything, get a hold of me.
Right in.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move to the next song. And this next one carries some emotional heft as well. We're going to go to the collaboration with The Roots in 2013. And the track is The Puppet Has Cut Its Strings.
They pull the stars down one by one. Hold up the moon to shine upon. A velvet curtain rising. Now her puppet is cut his strings. The footlights glare, the trumpets blare. Why is your face drawn on so glum, old chum? Paintbrush dragging on a drum. The rim shot, the rim shot of a punchline that shot. You fumbled.
Wise Up Ghost is such an interesting album. It's an album that in many ways is it's an angry album. There's a lot of simmering anger in there. It's dirty because it has a lot of scuzzy, distorted funk guitar, and it's got those great Questlove snares and kicks, but it's also lush with the full orchestra sound. So it's got a lot going on. It's an album that looks outward, except for this track. And this track was not on the standard edition of Wise Up Ghost. This is a song that was included later on as a bonus track. And to me, it's part of the album. I can't listen to the album without it being on it. It's such a deep and moving song. It was written, it later came out that it was written about Elvis's father passing away. The lyrics to it are sort of this collection of almost unconnected images and ideas. But when you view it through that lens, it makes sense. It's trying to make sense of loss, and it's trying to make sense of grief, and it's your eyes darting across the room while you're trying to come to terms with this horrible truth. The chords, the piano chords that repeat throughout the song. It's a very, like a lot of Wise Up Ghost, it's kind of drony and kind of repetitive in an interesting sort of experimental way. But these chords sound so broken and like they're about to fall apart at any point because Elvis's vocal doesn't seem to be fully in sync with it. Notably, Elvis's vocal, I think, was recorded on an iPad. And it has this immediacy to it. It has this tinny nature to it that really does sound like you're listening to somebody's inner monologue. It's one of those songs that, you know, it's mournful. It's solemn. As somebody who was also going through a loss at that time, I remember the thick fog of it and how it completely smothers every part of your life. And this song, and not only the music and the lyrics, but also just the feel of it, the texture of it, the sound of it, captures that quite beautifully.
Elvis said writing about his dad's final days was something he told himself would be too hard to visit in song. He describes it as a deeply upsetting series of images about my father's last breath, which I could only let myself utter in the company of new friends. The track was laid down by Questlove and Ray Angry. As you say, Elvis sang one take of the vocal at his kitchen table, using only the microphone on his computer or his laptop. He goes to record the proper vocal the next day, but Questlove said, no, you've got the vocal for the song. And it's I haven't really got much to say about it, to be honest, because I just find it quite an upsetting song to listen to. As you say, lots of people listening in will identify with the emotions of the song and the sentiments of it. And maybe we should just leave people to think about that themselves when they listen
for sure
to the song. It's it's incredibly personal, but it has that universality, doesn't it? That when you've been through the same thing, you recognize the pain that somebody else is going through.
Yeah. It captures an emotion so well in a way that I don't think any other song that I know of has been able to. The transcription of emotion to music is really remarkable there.
Hmm. Okay. I think everyone needs a little deep breath and a sip of water, and then we can, we'll move on to the next song and just change the mood a little bit with the next one.
Great that we live in this time, and it's so great that we've picked this musician as our favorite, because what a generosity of quality, what a generosity of timelessness. You know, he's still making some of his best music. It's 40 years later and he's still putting out these amazing songs and these amazing albums. The Boy Named Iv, the album, I think, is up there with his best. And that's just an insane thing to say about a guy who's been doing it for as long as he has. And The Boy Named If, the title track, I think is such a fun song. It's the total opposite to the last two songs we talked about in terms of fun. But it's such a fantastic song. It really shows off the Imposters and their playing. Also shows off how different the Imposters are from the Attractions. It's not only in the fact that, you know, Davey is a different member, but also the fact that Steve and Pete just play differently now. They're much looser. And this song is this stomping, loud number with Elvis at his sort of angry, well, not angry, but he's definitely loud. He's definitely aggressive in this one. And it's a song about sort of the horrors of childhood in many ways, but it's played with such gusto. It's impossible to think that these guys aren't having fun when they're making this. And it's crazy also that they recorded this completely separately, right? Like they did this long distance during the COVID lockdown. It's nuts. It sounds like you're in the room with them. And it's a beautifully produced album. Sebastian Chris is an incredible addition to the Elvis Costello world, because the albums that they've been making together since they hooked up, oh my God, they've been some of the best. And I struggled very hard between picking this song, which I love, or something from Hey Clock Face, which is also an amazing album that maybe doesn't get talked about often enough.
Yeah, kind of gets a bit lost between the two stools, doesn't it, of Look Now and The Boy Named If. But it's in a way, it's the one that keeps revealing more the more that you listen to it. It's like less obvious record than the ones either side of it. But yeah, that run of records is great. And you've interviewed Sebastian, haven't you, for your publications as well?
Yeah, when Spanish Model was coming out, I found out that he, well, you know, with La Lalista, we write about Argentine culture, right? So it's not often that I'm able to interview people from other countries unless they're coming here for a show or, you know, in this case, Sebastian was, I was trying to find a way to write something about Elvis Costello or related to Elvis Costello for a while. And then it came out that Spanish Model was featuring several Argentine artists, and Sebastian is from Argentina. So we hooked up and we talked on the phone. It was a great conversation. Great guy. Honestly, I'm so happy that that Elvis has found this partner in producing, because they've made some amazing music together.
Yeah, and this record, The Boy Named If, the title track, I think is one of the standouts on there. And Elvis said, "If is a nickname for an imaginary friend, the one who knows everything you deny, the one you blame for the shattered crockery and the hearts that you break."
It's filled with so many fun, because it's a big rock song, but it's not a dumb rock song at all. It's filled with so many fun little touches, that ascending line, it's so good. The way it's constructed, it's so fun. It's like maximum earworm. I think that Elvis, after years of people asking, hey, what's a good Elvis Costello album to introduce people to, I think he got fed up with that question, and he was like, let me make it. Let me just go ahead and make it, because this is the perfect introductory Elvis Costello album, in my opinion. It's accessible, but it has all the hallmarks of what makes him great.
Yeah. The Boy Named If, released in January 2022, performed by Elvis and the Imposters and produced by Sebastian Chris and Elvis Costello. So they're the six songs that you're going to add onto the playlist for us. We're going to call it Powder and Perfume, and we'll make it live at the end of this season on the podcast. But we're going to just do something a little bit different to end the episode now, because so many guests who come on the podcast and talk about being an Elvis Costello fan, they talk about how it's introduced them to new and different types of music, either through Elvis talking about a particular act and recommending a song, or by recording with them. So in that spirit, you've got some recommendations for us from your adopted homeland, and you've picked out some Argentinian music that you think fans of Elvis Costello, people who listen to this podcast, would enjoy.
Yeah, I you know, in my capacity as a music writer and editor of La Lalista, I found so many great local musicians in the Argentine music scene. Anytime I get a chance to show them off or to share them with people, I will take that chance. So these are some local musicians that are part of the Argentine music scene that I think share some similarities, or at least maybe they share some aspects with Elvis Costello's music that I think people might be into. So this is a song by an Argentine artist called Barbie Recanati. This is from her album Ubicación en Tiempo Real. Barbie used to be the lead singer of a band called Utopians. Utopians split up. She ventured off into a solo career that's amazing. She's also the co-founder of a local independent record label called Goza Records. And she has lyrics that are sharp, biting, acerbic in that this year's model kind of way, but are also deeply melodic and very catchy. I think everybody that I've shown Barbie Recanati to has fallen in love with her music, and I think everybody should listen to her. The second pick is María Pien. María Pien is also an Argentine singer-songwriter. She is a solo artist. She has 4 solo albums and many, many EPs. And she's also the guitarist and singer for the band Ruiseñora. Now, over the course of her career, she's shown tremendous growth, and I sort of see that in parallel with Elvis Costello, the way that they've not only honed their sound, but also ventured off and explored different sounds at the same time. There's a willingness to explore, and there's a willingness to let people into her sort of emotional life. This emotional vulnerability that I see reflected in a lot of her work. She's also, like Elvis Costello, a champion for other musicians. She's always lifting her peers. She's always covering people that she thinks deserve more attention. She's championing the song as an art form, and I see that parallel very clearly there. Next up, this is Nahuel Briones. This is also an Argentine singer-songwriter. I love the experimental nature of his music. He's very eclectic. He likes to play with unconventional arrangements. If somebody's a big fan of Mighty Like a Rose, I think this is a good artist to explore. There's also a sense of simmering anger in some of his songs that I think call to mind some of the angrier Elvis Costello moments. Un racimo de palabras que te supo mal. Me tocaste como una balada hecha para llorar. Cuando queda descubierta la verdad, no es tan fácil ni quedarse ni escaparse, pero soy libre igual. Then we have Mariana Michi. She's, oh my God, she's a powerhouse. She's part of a few bands. She's part of Miau Trio, which is this sort of folk group. And she's also part of a punk trio called Mugre. But she also does her own stuff. She has this great experimental pop sound. And I find that some of her melodic turns and instrumental choices are very Castellian, so to speak. I think she's one of the greatest that I've personally found here in Argentina. And finally, you know, I picked the wording musicians and the Argentine music scene very deliberately because Emily Ann is actually, she's American, but she has been living in Argentina for many years and she's certainly established herself here in the local scene. She plays a lot of shows. And I think her music features a lot of Castellian. I don't know if that's an adjective that we want to make into a thing, but I'm doing it anyway. A lot of traits, you know, there's a lot of wordplay. There's a lot of alliteration, especially like the early Castello stuff is very present in her music. She also sings in Spanish and in English and is extremely prolific. She puts out so much music. She recently had a project where she produced 100 songs or something like that. There are songs that, you know, they span the gamut. You know, some of them are very melodically sophisticated, others are very simple. But what's common is the tunefulness and this sort of startling emotional sincerity in her music that I think a lot of people would like. Those are my recommendations. Again, there's so many great artists in the Argentine music scene that are worth exploring. Some of them maybe sound a little closer to Elvis Costello in some ways, you know, but this is a great little starter kit if you want to start exploring what's happening currently in the Buenos Aires underground.
Fantastic. Oh, thank you so much for doing that and coming up with some of those suggestions. As we say, I think it's very much in the spirit of all things Elvis Costello, isn't it? To try and signpost people to other kinds of music that we think they'll enjoy as well. So, yeah, thank you for doing that. We'll put some links to those tracks in the show notes for this episode as well, so people can go and listen to them in full. And maybe we should run a competition for listeners to write the definition of what Castellian actually means. I'd be interested to see people come up with that as the official description of it.
For sure.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Well, let's just come round full circle then and end where we started, which is with our man Elvis Costello. How would you summarize what his music means to you?
He is the soundtrack to my life. In very simple terms, that's what it is. I started listening to him when I was maybe 15, and ever since then. So he's been with me for the entirety of my adult life, and I can chart milestones, I can chart significant moments, I can chart defeats, and I can chart victories to songs that I latch on to and listen to over and over again. His voice, I think, is one that many people will associate with me forever because I'm the Elvis Costello guy in the group. Anytime there's an Elvis Costello news article or something like that, when he popped up in the news because of Olivia Rodrigo, people were linking me to that all the time. I don't know. There's a very personal connection there. It's something that I think every EC mega fan experiences. I am forever grateful that I have this incredible lens through which to absorb a wealth of music. I'm forever grateful that I've latched my Apple wagon to this amazing musician who's still trailblazing all these years later. I hope that I get to see him again for the third time in my life. He never tours Latin America, and I go to New York quite often. I know he plays New York a lot, but for whatever reason, every time I'm there, he's not playing a show. But I'm hoping that this happens at some point. But even if it doesn't, I'm grateful that I have his music to accompany me in every significant moment of my life.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for that. Thank you for coming on and spending some time with us, picking those Elvis songs out and for picking out those other songs to recommend to other people as well. It's been great chatting to you.
Stu, it's been fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on. That was a great treat. I never get to talk to anybody about Elvis Costello, so this was years of pent-up conversation just immediately burst open.
Thank you to Jorge. You can find him on social media on X and Instagram as Jorge Farah or at Everyest. And you can find more of his work on lalista.com. Now, the Argentinian songs that Jorge has recommended to us all, I will put links to those in the show notes for this episode, wherever you are listening to the podcast. And of course, his Elvis song choices will go onto the playlist on my website at the end of the season, dangerousamusements.co.uk. You can find the podcast on X, on Instagram, and on Threads. And as ever, grateful for your 5-star ratings and reviews wherever you listen to the podcast. The theme music for Dangerous Amusements is performed by Gary Mulcahy.
That's all for this episode of Dangerous Amusements. Take my hand and let's go to Magic Lantern Land.